Hey folks, thank you for tuning in. Now, before we begin with today's show, just want to mention a couple of things. Actually, this program took a little bit of a different turn than I initially had intended. We ended up speaking about the positive aspects of artificial intelligence and how it can be used. While I initially had my sights set on talking about the threats of AI, and also, of course, kind of where in the process we are in building artificial intelligence. But, you know, James Bowery, our guest today, is really a brilliant mind, and a little bit difficult for that reason to rein in at times, I admit. But he has really interesting ideas. He's worked on a ton of different projects, some that has panned out, others that haven't yet. But he also has links to some of the people that, for example, went on to, you know, lay some of the groundwork. We'll go through this later. For example, Google's DeepMind, their artificial intelligence, you know, experiment, if you will, project. And he also has connections with people who later went on to work on such projects too. So our conversation is a little bit spread out in the beginning, to be honest, but we tie it nicely together in a very interesting way as we get deeper into the discussion. So if you are interested in artificial intelligence and theories about how it can be used, especially in the fight against globalization and the internationalists, definitely stay tuned and have a little bit of patience, and I think you'll enjoy this conversation. So let's just dive into it. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us here. This is Henrik with Red Ice TV, and I did a video a few days ago about the actual situation in Saudi Arabia with the ascent of artificial intelligence, and I was contacted by our guest today, who's back on the show, James Bowery, to actually talk a bit more about artificial intelligence and actually dive into the mechanics of it, how far along we are, and it turns out when James contacted me, he said that he actually had some knowledge about some of the people working within the field, some of the people that have been developing it. So I'm looking forward to basically finding out a bit more about where are we when it comes to artificial intelligence? How close to, if any at all, are we to this becoming sentient, if we even can put it in those terms? And if this is a danger, pose a danger, I believe it does to a certain extent. Whether it's conscious in the sense that we think of it could, of course, be argued. But James, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here again.
Thanks a lot, Henrik. I really appreciate coming on here. It's important, and I appreciate you guys taking the esoteric into the exoteric. Very few artists are doing that, and they really need to be doing more of it.
I agree, definitely. Excellent. Thank you, James. So how should we begin the topic, do you think? Well, what's the best thing to kind of explain to the audience? And remember, we have a lot of neophytes on this topic, and they don't know much about it. So how do you see artificial intelligence, and where are we in the development of that today?
Well, artificial intelligence is defined in a number of different ways. Actually, intelligence itself is defined in a number of different ways. The kind of intelligence that people have in the past talked about being artificial intelligence was mimicking human beings. The thing about human beings is they're not evolved specifically to be intelligent. We're evolved for perhaps a higher purpose, in my opinion at least, that has to do with our heritage, going back to the origin of all. And getting into the mechanics of something like a machine learning system really takes us into things like the scientific method, things that have been developed by human beings, but are not central to our meaning and central to our evolutionary direction. Science is different in the sense that when you get information in, you're not supposed to throw it away. You don't throw any data away. You keep all data around because what may have been noise or error or mistakes or whatever in a measurement could turn out to be something that should have been accounted for in your theory. And this occurs throughout the history of science. And for example, you have things like the Newtonian worldview, which was changed to a large degree when relativity came along and started talking about changes in the clock rates and things of that nature. But the things you could observe in the ordinary world were so, the differences with Newtonian mechanics were so small that things like that could be attributed to experimental error. So, but in true science, you don't throw away those errors. You keep them around and you admit them. what organic beings like us do is different. I mean, we do keep around, we do have a memory of a lot of things and details, but we tend not to pay attention to things that we know to be irrelevant from our experience. And so this is one of the reasons that it's important to distinguish between trying to mimic natural intelligence and what people are concerned about with respect to artificial intelligence, creating these super brains that overwhelm us. The important thing about throwing data away is that when you throw data away, you're really not ready to revisit that data and reconstruct your worldview. But people do that to some extent. We're capable of doing that. We don't just succumb to what's called confirmation bias all the time. If something comes along that is painful enough, consistently enough, we start to pay attention to our bad expectations. And then we start to try to revisit our worldviews. In science, that is really a central feature. At least it's supposed to be. But science being a human pursuit, people don't tend to do that. Clearly, when you talk about institutional science, where you've got politics, you have momentum, and you really do start throwing things away that you shouldn't be throwing away. So it's far from an ideal situation. So what I would say is that the most important thing is to understand is that there's a difference between observations that fit with our worldview and observations that don't fit with our worldview, but we attribute to some fluke or other thing that's maybe we don't really care about the fact that it doesn't fit with our worldview because it's not important to us. And this scientific method that is supposed to keep around all of the errors. The most important thing that people miss, and this includes the experts in the field, this includes people right at the heart of the world centers of artificial intelligence. What they don't get is that there's something called lossless compression of data. That's different from the kind of compression that, for example, is being used to transmit the video and the audio that we're sharing right now, where you throw things away to save on what's called bandwidth. You don't have as many bits going over because you're throwing a lot of the data away that's not relevant to human perception.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lossless compression is different. Lossless compression reproduces exactly what the sensor saw or whatever the measurement was. And that is really the difference between the potential for true artificial intelligence of this kind of alien form and the natural intelligence that we embody, where there's not as much attention paid to things that we consider to be irrelevant by our experience. I believe I sent you along a link about an effect where they showed people videos of somebody saying fa, fa, fa while they heard the words ba, ba, ba. And those experiments showed that people would actually hear what they saw. And this is very reproducible, very consistent. And it's due to the fact that we have our expectations can actually modify our senses. And this is a phenomenon known as confabulation, and it takes place all the way up into the neocortex. So there's a sense in which we live in a dream. It's a dream that's constructed by our nervous system to fill in all the missing data and all the irrelevant details so that we can get on with the things that are important to us. Because what's important to us is not simply, you know, being scientists all the time. We want to live lives.
And,
we have lives
and all
to
the
live.
Data that's available through our sensory input out there, right? That's just,
right.
That's too much.
Right.
Yeah, we have to filter. No,
and that's right. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why modern cosmopolitan environments are so toxic, because of the fact that we aren't built for them. were built for environments that have things that are more relevant to us based upon the kind of beings that we actually are.
Yeah.
So the insistence that we continually, you know, avoid prejudice and, you know, all these kinds of things, these are all things that nervous systems do as an inherent part of their structure. So we're being asked to continually be scientists to try to get along in the world. And we're not scientists. We're human beings. And it's really kind of an inhumane thing to treat people as though they're supposed to be scientists and not be prejudiced at all when they have to rely on their learning. And that learning is going to bias the way in which they see the world and allow them to get on in the world. But if you have an artificial scientist that's just a machine, it is ideally going to be taking in every bit of information, and it's going to see if it fits with its current model, and if it doesn't, it's going to reconstruct its model on the fly. And the way it's going to do that is based on Occam's razor. And for people who don't know what Occam's razor is, basically all it means is that if you have a bunch of information available to you, and you want to try to use that information to predict what's going to happen next, the best model or the best theory that you can come up with based upon that data is the simplest one, if you include the errors. In other words, if you have some measure of the complexity of the model and you have some measure of the errors, all in terms of bits of information, the number, for example, we're running over, say, a megabit per second channel right here. If you've got that, then you have a measure of the total complexity of your model that's lossless. You've taken everything into account. And if you can come up with the minimum size model that has been proven to be the best or the most likely model, or the model most likely to predict the next bit or next observation, it's mathematically shown that that's the case. So, and this has actually been known more or less since the 1930s, when Russell and Whitehead's Principia Mathematica was this just enormous effort to turn mathematics and logic into a form that could be thought in modern terms to be computational. It was so rigorous that you could put a machine on it and it would start cranking out theorems and things of that nature. A guy named Harold Jeffries in the 1930s, he was a statistician, utilized that to show that if you could minimize the size of that formal model along with the errors, that you would have the most likely predictions for the future. It wasn't until the early 1960s that a guy named Ray Solomonoff came up with what's called algorithmic probability. There were other guys, Kamal Karoff and Chaitin, that about the same time, I mean, it was really, the time was pregnant for this to happen. These were all based on computers. Jeffries didn't have computers in his time, but computers were really coming into their own in the early 60s. And it was shown that if you used Turing's model of the computer, which is this very simplified tape machine, that you could prove that you had that the smallest program that produced all of the observations without any loss was the program that, if you let it continue to run, would start to spit out the future observations that were most likely to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So you're able to predict, and this is central to science, being able to predict. It's also central to compression, because if you know what the next bit's going to be, you don't need to store it, right? You know, if you know that,
right.
That, you know, so that's really the fundamental connection between the two. And people, you know, people sort of understand Occam's razor. I mean, you know, it's been stated in a million different ways, going clear back, of course, to Occam, which is basically that, you know, well, you know, it seems like if this is the simplest explanation, I'm going to go with it. But there's more to it than simply, you know, the practical aspect of being able to keep something in your head that makes, you know, that you can handle. it actually is more likely to produce accurate predictions. And humans do this to some extent, and it's just that we're not perfect at it. Computers, however, can try to be perfect at it. The problem is that it's been shown by Kamal Groff, this Russian mathematician, that if you have a bunch of observations encoded as data, and you try to produce the what's called the Kamal Groff program, the smallest program that can output exactly the data without loss, there's no way to prove that you've actually found that smallest program. And there are some trivial cases, but they aren't relevant to the real world or the natural sciences. So what this means is that we don't know ever if we found the best theory given a set of observations. All we can say is that the simpler our lossless model of the world is, the better it is in general. And we can also compare two different theories in that way. In other words, given the same data, and you have two different schools of thought or something, and you say, okay, well, you know, school of thought A, you think that the world is this way, and school of thought B, you think the world is this way, produce the smallest program that outputs these data sets. And then they come back and they compare the sizes of their programs. And that's actually what we did with something called the Hutter Prize for Lossless Compression of Human Knowledge in 2006. What happened was I was very frustrated with Wikipedia. I was also very frustrated with what was happening to the software industry, with all the H-1B hordes that were coming in that were populating the Fortune 1000 and creating just a mess with software. And I had suggested to Ray Ozzie, who took over the architecture position from Gates, that one thing that could be done to increase software quality would be to award a prize for programmers within Microsoft that could write the smallest program that could generate all of the features of the Office suite for Microsoft. And I did this without knowing these theorems in mathematics. It just seemed like it was the right thing to do. And then I started looking at what was going on with Wikipedia with all this information sabotage. And you got just, you know, if you look at the articles on race and things like that that are controversial, they're just nightmares.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, and it was really, I mean, you know, going in there and editing the thing is just futile, right? Because you've got these, again, you've got these hordes of people that have their agendas and they figured out the rules of Wikipedia and they go through and they try to make it so that anything that might, you know, be realistic about these controversial issues just gets deep-sixed or overwhelmed with noise. And what I wanted to do was come up with a way to identify the kinds of psychology and the kinds of people, if not the actual people themselves, that were responsible for creating disinformation in Wikipedia, what's called information sabotage by some. And I again thought, well, if I could come up with a prize that compressed Wikipedia maximally, I was looking really at the change log to compress the change log, which is much bigger. I have a prize to maximally compress it, and I took a clue from the Methuselah Mouse prize, which is a prize where if you, say, have a mouse and you're providing it with a treatment to increase its longevity, the longer your mouse lives, the more of the Methuselah Mouse prize you get, but only if it's more than the last benchmark for a mouse prize. So I applied that to the Wikipedia compression, and I started talking to people about it. Well, it turns out that a guy named Matt Mahoney, who's in charge of the large text compression benchmark and has developed one of the best compression algorithms. It's held records up until recently as the best. Told me that he had actually worked on using compression to pass the Turing test. And I talked to him a little bit more about it, and turned out that this guy named Marcus Hutter, who was at the Swiss Institute for Artificial Intelligence, had published a general theory of artificial intelligence called, you know, universal intelligence or artificial general intelligence, and he'd actually solved formally the intelligence problem, period. And he did it with lossless compression, based upon this prior work that goes clear back to Jeffries, but he most directly did it based on Ray Solomonoff's algorithmic probability.
Right.
So I approached Marcus with this and, you know, suggested, I mean, he had previously put a prize up of his own, and which enamored me of him, because I had put up a prize called the Bowery Award for Amateur Rocketry back in 95 of $1,000 for an amateur rocketry group that could reach 100 kilometers with their rocket. And some guy came along, I can't remember his name, he was a cell phone billionaire, and took my criteria and put $300,000 behind it, called the Cheap Access to Space Prize, the CATS Prize. And then shortly thereafter, then that got Carmack, the guy that did Doom and all these 3D games, and interested, and he started working on stuff. And then the XPRIZE committee got funded
right.
to do the 100-kilometer man thing. And from and that happened around the time that all this money got shaken loose from Wall Street by the .com thing. So Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos got their you know, money together to do their rocket companies.
Yeah, that's right.
So there was actually a cascade effect there that was pretty profound.
And you were, so you're saying, just to clarify that to people, you were involved in that with the Hutter Prize and all that stuff, and you were in with those guys at that point, right?
Well, no, what I'm talking about goes back before the Hutter Prize. I'm talking about the reason that I was so enamored of Hutter, because he had previously offered prizes. I mean, it's not every day you run across somebody who puts their own money up to offer a technology achievement, you know, prize award for some objective criteria.
Sure.
And there's all kinds of quote challenges unquote out there that basically say, we have a challenge to solve world hunger, right? And so you get a bunch of people writing essays or doing various random things, and it's all up to the judges as to whether that prize is awarded. And those things inevitably get awarded for politically correct, you know, people, and
certainly
they don't really solve it.
Yeah.
But if you have an objective criteria that the judges don't have much discretion on, then it's a fair contest. It's a fair competition. And that will attract the high quality talent, because they'll know that it's not just not just one of these things where it's a social status game being played by whoever has the money for their friends who are going to be judges or whatever. Right.
Good point.
So, you know, when the CATS Prize guy came along with $300,000, and then that sort of lit a fire under the X Prize guys, and the Ansaris came in and put up money based upon an insurance thing. There was a real cascade effect there. And, when I saw Hutter put up some money for, I can't remember what the prize was about, I thought, okay, this is great. So I approached him, and he immediately got it.
€50,000? Was that it?
Right. That was, and I approached him in 2005, and he may have been joking, but he said he sold his Ferrari. I don't know. I think really what's going on is, since it's an incremental prize, and he knows that there's a minimum size that you can compress the thing to, and it's really hard to do it. In fact, it's impossible to determine if you've actually achieved it. He probably was joking, because he knew he would never have to award the entirety. In other words, if you could compress it down to zero, I think, then you get the entire $50,000.
Right.
But anyway,
right.
But he loosened that up, and we set the criteria up so that people who didn't have a lot of money, but had computers, you know, fairly inexpensive computers, say people in Russia, where you have really great mathematicians, but at the time, you know, especially they didn't have a lot of money. And a lot of these really talented kids just, you know, all they could get was maybe a gigabyte of RAM if they were lucky.
If even that, yeah.
And so we set the bar, the resource restrictions very, very low, so that, you know, IBM couldn't come in with, you know, a whole bunch of computers, and but still emphasized intelligence on the part of the programmer to be able to do this. So Alexander Rushniak was a kid that actually did exactly that out of Russia. And in fact, just today, he sent in a new prize entry, which has improved things by 4%, which is really huge when you're already squeezed out a lot of the easy, you know, low-hanging fruit in the compression. And what this is doing is it's modeling the English language as represented by Wikipedia, and doing so in an optimal way so that you can predict what's going to come next. And you try to, if you can, include things like concepts and semantics and other things, so that if you know what the general topic area is, you know, a certain vocabulary is more likely to be used, so you can, you know, bet on certain sequences of words, et cetera. Anyway, he just came in with something like that today. We haven't been able to get the kind of, I mean, really, I believe that this kind of prize is worthy of literally billions being, you know, backing it. Because if you can take something like Wikipedia, especially the full corpus or even the changelog at those kinds of scales, and have an objective prize criteria that you know is going to advance the state of the art in natural language processing, you're not wasting any money. The money that's being spent is incremental, and it's only for improvements on an objective basis with no judge discretion. And this is a very, very powerful concept, and I'll tell you why it's not being paid attention to, or why I know it's not being paid attention to by the highest status experts in artificial intelligence. Jeffrey Hinton, if you could bring up the article that I sent you about Jeffrey Hinton's concern about backpropagation that he's recently come out with.
Yeah, this one here.
Yeah, Jeffrey Hinton, you'll hear a lot about that. That's my response to him, but we can go with that. Jeffrey Hinton is the guy who came up with, at least he's attributed, the invention of what's called deep learning. And if you look at all of the various claims to fame about artificial intelligence advances out of Google, especially, you'll see that they almost invariably reference deep learning. And what Hinton actually did was he came up with some ways of doing some stuff that was actually being done very early on back in the 80s when I was first getting into neural networks. But the algorithms weren't very efficient. There was these restricted Boltzmann machines is what they called them. And as computers got faster and faster, they were able to explore that potential a bit more. And once they started getting results, they started putting more effort into the mathematics and they could optimize things. Hinton has recently come out and sort of dissed his own work in deep learning. And what he basically said was that there's a problem with deep learning in that you have to have labeled data. And if you use websites a lot now, they'll ask if you're a robot, and they'll put up these pictures, and you have to like select which of the pictures contains like cars or something like that. And what you're really doing is you're actually providing what's called labeled data to some of these learning algorithms, as well as being tested for your own intelligence as a machine versus human. And so that's providing labeled data. Now, what's labeled data? Well, labeled data basically says, if I present an intelligence with this little picture of, say, an image that may contain a car or not, I label the ones that contain cars as containing cars, and I label the ones that don't contain cars as not containing cars, right? And you can use that to train these deep learning backpropagation systems. The reason that you can use those to train those is that with those backpropagation systems, you reward and punish the learning. And if you get it wrong, if the neural net gets it wrong, then the wrongness propagates backward through the neural network to the inputs, and you adjust all of your learning accordingly. If you look at that in terms of science, what we do with science is we construct theories, and then we make hypotheses for experiments. We make predictions for experiments, and then we run experiments to see if our predictions hold. The labeled data is like having the outcome set up for you. In other words, you're testing your, what you do is you take a model, you take a neural net, and you run it as though you run an experiment, and you make a prediction. And then you say, well, what was the actual result? The labeled data tells you what the actual result is. So you know if you were right or wrong. Okay, so there's a connection between the experimental method and labeled data and and what's called supervised learning or backpropagation in that sense. Hinton isn't quite there with Occam's razor yet. If he understood Occam's razor, he would understand that an algorithmic probability and its true relevance to artificial intelligence, he would understand that what he's looking for, and he's calling for a revolution in artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah.
Because of this. I mean, he's worked on this for a number of years, made tremendous practical strides in image recognition and machine translation. You use Google Translation. It uses those kinds of technologies. What he's looking for in a revolution is something that is called unsupervised learning of the data. Well, that's exactly what you're doing with compression that's lossless. If you get optimal compression without loss of the data, you don't have to have labeled data. What you have is the model labeling the data for you in an optimal way. And there's a trade-off here. In other words, for example, Google has this website called Kaggle.com. And people will go in there and they'll have these competitions and they'll prize awards for artificial intelligence. And I went in there recently and I said, it's interesting that you guys are taking, on your contest, you take half the data and you let people train with that. There are artificial intelligence machines with that. And then the other half of the data then you use to test it to see if it's actually making correct predictions. Why don't you try to take advantage of the fact that algorithmic probability shows that if you compress all of the data optimally, you can compare theories for quality by the inverse of their size, how small they are. And they came back and said, I pointed them to a prize competition that I've set up recently about social data, and they said, "Oh, could you send us the social data you've got?" And it's like, "Well, could you answer my question?" And what's going on is that people just they don't understand this thing about training data versus the raw data and modeling, and the relevance of algorithmic probability properly. There are a lot of different people who are, come to the threshold of this, and then they make various errors in understanding. One of the most egregious errors is they say something like, "Oh, well, it's been proven that you can't find the smallest program by or whatever." It's like, well, yeah, but that's not really the point. The point is being able to compare two different theories, both of which are not going to be perfect. Because we're limited human beings and we got limited machines,
right?
And the reason that's the most egregious one is because this is among people who really should know better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, But there's another set of people that make this error, or make a different kind of error that's related. And one of them is Jonathan Haidt. He's frequently cited by people on the right because he's had criticisms of social justice warriors and political correctness, and he's a social scientist.
Yeah.
But, and the reason he's committed an egregious error is that he is perfectly positioned to be able to take this into the realm of social data. But he wrote an essay on what concepts in science should be discarded. And his answer was Occam's razor.
Hmm.
And I understand some people will make this error, and it's relatively forgivable. Scott Adams, for example, in his most recent book, How to Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. Okay, and what he's dealing with primarily is human psychology. And he criticizes Occam's razor from the standpoint that, you know, if you have facile, basically what he's saying is we always throw away information in the form of confirmation bias. So if we think that we've got all the data that we're taking into account with our simpler theory, then we're really fooling ourselves. So it's really a bad idea to rely on Occam's razor in that respect. And he's correct from the standpoint of the human foibles. But when it gets to somebody like a social scientist, especially somebody who's trying to fight against the shibboleths of political correctness, cultural Marxism, et cetera, and really has the opportunity to get major resources out of like Harvard University and major data resources and apply this principle to try to compare social theories, for him to come out and argue against that is really unforgivable. There are folks out there that are running around like the Ford Foundation, and you know there also have been occurrences where you've got there was this phony artificial intelligence thing that I think Microsoft did that was hacked by 4chan to say Hitler did nothing wrong or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Right? and so you've got stuff like that going on, but you've also got stuff where this goes clear back to the actuarial sciences, where you've got guys just basically saying we want to predict, you know, how much we should charge for our insurance premiums, and they'll find racist information, and then they're barred by law from taking those things into account. Then they simply find ways of rederiving that through what's called imputation, and it comes up with the same conclusions based upon other data. The point is that, you know, there's real stuff out there that is racially based, upon which you can make rational, informed judgments that right. are scientific and, you know, scientifically based, mm-hmm. not just, you know, based on human irrationality, based upon, you know, what we've seen, but, you know, taking into account a wide range of data. What's going on with that now? It's gone beyond somebody trying to restrict the insurance companies. You've got places like the Ford Foundation that's coming out against use of social data in a rigorous way, because they claim that there's all this bias built into the data because there's white males involved.
Right.
And, you know, the thing about this is that, and then this is something that social scientists will pull out every time you confront them with this kind of thing. It's like a go-to argument. You know, the data is biased. And one can make that argument to, you know, in a somewhat defensible form if you've got, say, just a few measures, right? You've got, you know, say the crime statistics or something like that. And you've got rape or something. You look at rape, and so you've got like one, you know, thing, and you've got it broken down by, you know, victim and perpetrator. But the thing is that if people claim that something is biased, some data set is biased, they have to have some reason for saying that, right?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, if they're going to be, you know, in fact, just going to be pundits. If they're true scientists, then they have to have some reason for saying that. And the reason, if they're scientists, has to be data-based. Okay. So what they're really saying is that I've got some data over here that's inconsistent with this in a particular way that's systematic, that shows that the people that produce this data are white supremacists or whatever, right?
Right.
And the way they do that is they, essentially, implicitly say, we've applied Occam's razor to the total data set that includes all these measures and show that there's this outlying thing with the racial crime statistics that simply isn't consistent with the rest of our data and shows that it's biased in a way we would expect from white supremacists.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And that would be a reasonable thing to say, but they never do that. They never say that because they aren't doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's not what they're doing. What they're trying to do is squid ink science.
Okay. Because they want to control the narrative. And the interesting thing here, and I know you're on a roll, you have a thought that you're following through on here, but what's interesting,
that's okay. This is a point where I need a reaction. Okay?
Yeah.
We're going someplace else.
I have hundreds of them. I just wanted to let you go and see where you want to go with it. But the interesting here, the thing that I find about this is that if we get to a point where machine learning and artificial intelligence can be used as a system to aid the scientific process of basically finding out what is reality or what is true about X, you know, whatever it might be, is that it would reveal things in an objective matter, which the oligarchy, the ruling elite would not like, right? So that there's a need right now for them, I think, to control the input, control the data, as you say, limit the data, because if they would just let this loose on reality and give it everything it can take, I think it would be able to give us objective answers to certain things, such as you said, the crime statistics, right? And what are the reasons for this? This is the reality. It would prove, in effect, that things that they don't like, politically incorrect things such as race, is a reality and a viable thing that they would have to deal with. Is that, do you think, why they're seeking to control it in the way that they are?
I think at a subconscious level, the effort to suppress this, what's been known since the 1930s about data and modeling, okay, is precisely that. We are living in a theocracy, and they want to keep things on a theocratic basis because they want to interfere in everybody's judgments about the kind of environment in which they want to live.
Yeah.
They want to create a narrative. See, they don't want to let us just be human beings, right? If they let us be just human beings, we would have our own ethnostates. Right? If each individual is allowed to make his choice, we know what happens.
Yeah.
They choose their own kind. And the reason they choose their own kind is because that's what formed their ancestors. That's what formed them. And that's where they feel most comfortable. That's where they can live their lives and not have to be scientists all the time.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, and then they continually put these impossible burdens of proof on just human beings that are living their lives so that they can foist things like
diversity, multiculturalism, globalism.
Oh yeah. Just, I just want to share this. Okay. They can foist things like this on us.
1986, amnesty.
Yep. Well, from 1965 to 2015, we have steady increase of immigration rate.
Yeah.
Right? Well, look at this. Clear up until year 2000, over 90% of the people opposed increasing immigration. Now, how do you explain that in terms of consent of the governed?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the way you explain that is you've got a theocracy that have argued us into a corner where we can't be human beings and we can't even have an environment that's remotely like what we want.
Okay. Yeah.
And they've been able to achieve this by making it so that the actual science of social science doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Controlling information flow, steering it. And we know about the rewriting and excluding certain, finds reality, science that has been proven. And they do that to control the narrative. And I think that's a hugely important thing to them. But this, back to the AI question, do you think that an artificial intelligence would be able to aid us, if you will, in that process of giving us a more objective, realistic view of reality? And frankly, they must be afraid of what they might find. There are those other examples that you took, the Microsoft bot, right, that started. I mean, I know that, right, that was due to input from Twitter users or whatnot, but I've always been interested in that question. What can an AI tell us and tell us about ourselves and the nature of the world and reality, which we're shying away from, you know?
Right. Well, the thing, let me just give you an example. The thing that really, sort of tweaked me about a lot of this, before I started suggesting that this kind of compression stuff, even to about Wikipedia, was I had gathered a bunch of data to try to figure out what environmental causes there might be behind autism. I'd experienced this in Silicon Valley, a company where like five families had children born that were on autism spectrum. And it was a cluster, and I brought it up to Berkeley, a guy that was supposed to be looking into these kinds of things, and he just basically said, yeah, we know about these microclusters, we don't know causes and by, right? So it was left up to little old me to just go around and start gathering the data that I could, and I don't have much capacity to gather a whole lot of data, and I have had other things I have to do in life. But what I started doing was gathering data at the level of a state. So I had state-level data for things like mercury and, vaccinations and all, basically all of the standard theories that, mm-hmm. that you've got out there.
Yeah.
And I ended up with hundreds of variables of, at the state level, and started running correlations. Now, these are called ecological correlations in statistics. And this is actually, ecological correlations is the way you start doing epidemiology in almost all cases, because it's cheap, but it can also be misleading. And there's something called the ecological fallacy, as well as correlation doesn't imply causation, blah, blah, blah. But I had so many different measures, these hundreds of measures, that I could do things like rank order them according to how well they predict these various theories. And I, made some theory hypotheses of my own. But there was a point at which I stopped looking at the autism stuff and got interested in the fact that I had data like the number of Jews that were in each state, right? And, since I had for a long time considered, this Jewish thing to be an ecological phenomena that was important, and I had this data at the state level, I said, well, maybe there's something going on at the state level with Jews. And there were some interesting, that there were these top correlations with Jews and that like things like AIDS, which could be accounted for by just they're in urban areas and gays are in urban areas or whatever. But then what I did that was more interesting, and then gets back into this whole thing about using computers to start to ferret out, start to do compression and ferret these things out, was I went into every single measure, like IV drug use and, alcoholism and, mother's age, a first live birth, and everything, mm-hmm. Hundreds of measures. And I asked I wrote a program that went through and found which of those measures would most strongly predict the other measures on average. And one of the measures I put in there was Jewish percent of whites. And the reason I put that in there is because I saw this potential of there being an ecological conflict between whites and Jews as being very significant. Okay, people talk about Jews being, some kind of an enemy or something of whites. And, so Jewish percent of whites would tell us, as Jews become a greater percentage of whites, does that predict things better than, say, just number of whites or number of Jews or, IV drug use or whatever, right? And that came out on top. Jewish percent of whites came out on top. It was the most predictive of social ecology in the United States of any of the hundreds of measures. Now, that's something that they don't want to talk about.
Of course not.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this was relatively robust. I mean, I was able to, you know, change. I mean, I certainly had not biased the data set to do this. I was looking for autism. Okay. And I just happened to include the juice thing. And, you know, but you think about it and it's like, well, you know, I guess it kind of makes sense to people who have thought about the JQ and, you know, but, and we're continually, you know, told that we're like sickos, right? But we're not. We're not sickos. Okay. I mean, some of us are. Maybe we're being driven sick by the way in which we're being gaslit, okay, by social science. Yeah. That will not do this work. Okay. And this is just, you know, a very simple kind of thing that would, you know, say, well, which of these things allow us to actually compress the data more efficiently. Now there's an entire field of statistics called path analysis that's much more sophisticated than I did. Where you actually have, you know, a network that says, well, let's say, for example, we could predict the Jewish percent of whites by some other measures more than, and then we wouldn't have to rely on that as a primary measure. And then people will argue that, right? I mean, that's something that should be argued in legitimate social science, is saying, you know, maybe the Jewish percent of whites is just kind of an artifact of some other things, and that's what's really driving these other things, right? So you have some combination of effects or synergies. But path analysis allows you to do multi-level kinds of, you know, cascade of influence that is the best you can do in social science in terms of causal, in terms of standard statistical methods for discovering social causation. And if you're looking for social ills, you know, like crime rates school dropout rates or poverty or whatever you're looking for, this is in medicine, it's called etiology. You're looking for the causes of illness. And this is the best you can do in terms of social etiology. Right now is this kind of path analysis using standard techniques. But that's nothing compared to what you can actually achieve if you get into truly dynamical algorithms that take into account time. Because the path analysis isn't dynamical. You can't have feedback loops to say, you know, the state now feeds back into the model and then we get the next time increment of what things are going on. So this algorithmic probability automatically contains these kinds of dynamic analyses. They have to. And so that's one of the things that I really am very frustrated, because people talk about all these causes and all these dynamics and things like that in the alt-right. And we have at our disposal right now a tool that can nuke the social sciences as a pseudoscience.
Right.
Yeah. And the way it would work is, I believe, very similar to what happened with the rocketry prize that I set up at only $1,000. And I've set up this thing on the HeroX website called the Social Causality Prize One, that I will end up funding totally at $1,000 if I have to. I've only put up $100 right now. But basically what I did was I just took
this here it is.
I took the U.S. Census Bureau's data at the county level, not the state level, but the county level. They have a huge number of measures at the county level. That's a standard data set. In fact, this is the data set that I went to the Google's prize website called Kaggle and said, why don't you do this kind of thing with all of your data, right? Compress it. So this is basically offering a prize award for something like the Hutter Prize to optimally compress this. Now, since this is the Census Bureau itself, Jim Bowery didn't select this data. This is the Census Bureau's county level data. And they've stopped, by the way, collecting county level data. So this is actually an archival going up, I believe, to 2006 or thereabout. But it is a relatively complete, and it goes over a number of years. And it could be fleshed out to have more longitudinal data for more social dynamics. But the point is that this is the kind of thing where you have a broad range of measures. So if there is data that is biased, you can find out, because it will be inconsistent in the simplest model with a lot of other measures, right? If somebody's going in there monkeying with the stuff. And that's the same kind of principle that was behind the Hutter Prize for Lossless Compression of Human Knowledge that motivated me, because you'll have these guys that are coming up with, you know, statements that are inconsistent with the broad body of knowledge. They're playing games the way the social scientists and the, you know, Bayesian anthropologists have been doing for the last century.
Indeed. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was my motivation for putting that on the HeroX.com. That's actually a site that's sponsored by the XPRIZE Foundation.
And have you gotten any response to this?
I went into Quora. No, I haven't really. I went into Quora and I asked, you know, why is it that social scientists haven't been availing themselves of algorithmic probability in creating their models?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see what they said.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, you know, some social scientist came back in and he said some things like, well, you know, the data is biased and, you know, you can't rely on data. And I was like, what? You can't rely on data?
Yeah.
But he had done his own thing. And he had some kind of strange definition of probability. That's a probabilistic measure and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I kept on pressing him to try to find out where he'd actually break. And he actually came back with a statement that, because he had started talking about, you know, oppression, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, oppression is like the central concept. And so I said, well, you know, you need to start, you know, taking seriously these things like measurements and how do you measure oppression, et cetera. I can't remember if I said this explicitly, but something like that. And he came back and he said, you know, I said something like, you know, if you have, you know, oppression is a very vague term. And he said, well, you know, social science is based upon, you know, the sensual concepts that are not at all vague to us. You just can't measure them.
Nice.
This guy just got a PhD out of, in Canada. Of course, Canada's going to hell, right?
Yeah.
And it's because of this kind of crap.
Okay? Yeah.
I mean, you got these guys. And now, you know, some of the stuff, I mean, the Frankfurt School, wasn't the origin of all this kind of sophistry in social science, but you know, they were a big contributor.
Big parts, yeah.
And you know, basically attacking the whole idea of measurement and objectivity. And you know, there are problems with measurement and objectivity if you, you know, take them too far. But when we're dealing in the realm of, you know, public policy, where there people are claiming science as the justification, as for example, in the I believe in the 1950s, you had the desegregation of schools based upon a social science experiment that the Supreme Court took seriously, where they had some, you know, kids with dolls playing with black dolls and white dolls.
That's right. That experiment. I mean, it's so shady, all of that, when you begin to look into them and look at how they came to these conclusions and stuff. We did a video about this, a piece about this, like a couple of years ago now. And it was just, it's unbelievable that this was, you know, passed as a scientific, you know, study and that they did a court ruling based on that so-called study. It's amazing.
Right. Right. So, you know, I'm saying, look, you know, you guys want to pretend to be scientists. Fine.
Let's take it all the way.
Science. if you guys want to pretend to be scientists, we have these artificial scientists. And that's really what you're talking, when you're talking about artificial intelligence, you know, artificial general intelligence,
mm-hmm.
that's really what you're talking about. You're talking about a mechanical scientist that is given some kind of goal or some kind of value system.
And here's the other thing, James, to that as well, as I think it was Sam Harris or someone that explained that, but you know, there was the issue, of course, of how you define intelligence and what it is. Is it the processing of information or what is it and those kinds of things? But regardless, I think his example that he took was that an artificial intelligence can basically produce 10,000 years worth processing information or as compared to your regular Stanford team or whatever. He made some comparison, and I don't know how he quantified that particular artificial intelligence, but regardless, it was like it could be way ahead, basically, and it can work a tremendous amount more than humans can, right? And that can be an advantage in this case, can't it?
Yeah. It can, but a statement like what he's making. Let me put it like this. Okay, Sam Harris, you know, had an interview with Charles Murray, and I don't know if you heard that.
I did not.
It was really kind of pathetic. But he kept on coming back. Well, you know, well, you know, I really kind of regret having attacked you because I know there was all this stuff going on that, you know, but you, when I actually read your book, you know, it wasn't really, you know, what it was being portrayed as. And, you know, but I always, why even study racial differences? Right? And, you know, Murray came back and he said, well, you know, there's all these programs that the government has that, that are race-based, and we want to make sure that we're, you know, doing policies that are going to work, you know? And then later on in the interview, Harris didn't respond to that. He just like went on with whatever he was saying. And then later he says, but why do we have to study race-based?
Well, you know, so it's just, it's not valuable.
A complete moron.
Well, of course. I mean, it's just not valuable to them. I mean, this is basic stuff that, those things we can just exclude. It's not important in the bigger, we've moved on from that now. I mean, they're completely beyond that. And I didn't bring him up as an example of someone who's in that particular realm does good work. I don't even know anything what he thinks about that. I was just talking about the magnitude of work that machine learning could do when you compare it to humans. So I'm saying that it can process data in an incredible speed as compared to the human mind, basically. And that can be an advantage. That's it.
And right now, and this gets into sort of the state of the art in artificial intelligence, artificial general intelligence, if you will. Shane Legg, he had this video that I sent to you. Yeah. He gave back in 2010. There's a little bit of history there I should probably mention. Back when Hutter first put up his prize in 2006, I was actually contacted by one of Kurzweil's acolytes. Ray Kurzweil is Google's sort of, you know, artificial intelligence rabbi. And
I like that.
I mean, really, I mean, quite seriously.
Yeah, no, I know.
He identifies as a rabbi. And, yeah. And so I'm completely justified in using that term.
Unless you're talking about, what was it, Rayona? No, what was his feminine alter ego? Did you ever see that stuff? It's weird.
No.
He has this feminine alter ego when he, you know, creates a virtual reality version of himself, which is a female. And he calls it a Rayona or something like that. All weird stuff.
Whatever. You know, it's all the transhumanist stuff. We talk about that. But yeah. Anyway, so one of his acolytes, I think it's Michael Atenoff. I can't remember the last name. But anyway, he asked me. I mean, he actually looked back at my history and, you know, he wrote something that actually kind of got him in trouble. He said, you know, is Jim Bowery some kind of, you know, Bayesian genius or something like that? Because he had seen that I had previously to knowing about Hutter, I'd sort of intuited, you know, that was the proper approach to creating models was compression. But anyway, I think it was he that asked me, it might be in /.archive someplace, you know, what I suggested to people, to students who wanted to get into artificial intelligence. That was like, said, well, you know, they should be studying, if they wanted to get a job right now, they should just, you know, study imputation of missing data, because that's really something that all businesses need. You know, it's like, oh, well, we have all these measures on this customer, but we don't have, like, you know, sex or something like that. And you can impute what the sex is from the other data you've got. And that's that. You really have to have good artificial intelligence algorithms that take into account a wide range of measures to be able to impute one type of measure that you don't have. But I said, if you want to be serious, you know, say, you know, 10, 20 dart years down the road, you really should get a PhD from Marcus Hutter. And Shane Legg in 2009, I think, got a PhD from Marcus Hutter, and he went on to co-found Google DeepMind, along with some other of Hutter's PhD students.
Right. Interesting.
And Shane Legg in 2010 at the Singularity Summit gave a lecture that's really required viewing for anybody who is really interested in artificial intelligence.
I sent
to you.
Yeah, I've not seen that yet. I definitely need to take a look at that.
It's about measures of machine intelligence, and where he gets into the various definitions of intelligence and talks about the kind of intelligence that solves abstract problems as opposed to simply simulating human beings. And he went on, as I said, to co-found Google DeepMind. Google DeepMind, of course, did AlphaGo, which, you know, won the world.
Just won recently.
Won the Go world.
Yeah.
Yeah. and, you know, has all this other stuff that it's done. That's
now is fame. What was it? Something that it beat the first, the best human that we had, like, was it two couple of months ago, whatever. Now it's at the level where it can beat 8 of the world's best at the same time or something. It just advanced tremendously.
Well, I mean, apparently. Once you get to the point, and basically what it did is they just, you probably saw the movie War Games.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had this thing where this machine intelligence was like playing itself and then figured out that there's no winning a nuclear war, right? What they did is, and Bobby Fischer said that, you know, the way he learned to play chess is he played himself in his head. And that's what they did with this AlphaGo. They just basically had it play itself in its head. And it learned really well how to play Go.
Yeah.
But it used just standard deep learning algorithms to do that. Okay. And it could do that because it knows when it's winning and when it's losing. So, you know, it's like it doesn't have to rely on anything but you know, actual experiments to see whether it's doing well or not.
And is it the same thing there? Is it just that it can do it at such a speed that it can learn, like that it reaches the probability, like, it, you know, it advances because it can just process it so fast compared to a human. It can try and fail so many more times than a human can, for example.
Right. Well, you know, what it boils down to is you have different kinds of computer processing. There are certain kinds of computer processing that don't require communication between the different parallel processes, and they can just go off and have their own little universe and get things done. Those kinds of problems are very amenable to Moore's law as it's exponentiated the capacity of computers and increased the efficiency, I should say, the economy of getting another, you know, addition done. Right if you have to have a lot of communication, it's a different kind of thing. But I can talk about what the relevance of that, but when you're talking about Go, you can have a whole bunch of games going on simultaneously. So Google has these enormous server farms. You know, I mean, I lived actually just down the Columbia River from a place called the Dalles, where they set up this thing next to a hydroelectric plant. And they do that because they want to have electricity and they want to have water to cool off the electricity. Just, you know, huge amounts of computers that all run in parallel to do primarily their indexing and satisfying their queries. But it can be turned to things like this, where you just have just enormous numbers of processors all playing Go games at once and getting information that way about it. And I think that's basically what they did. It's a real brute force kind of learning. And as I said, it was based on this thing that the deep learning algorithms that, mm-hmm. that Hinton came up with,
yeah.
and others really came up with it prior to him in some way, can do in a relatively simple way. But it doesn't solve the hard problem where you're just getting this data in from an unknown source and trying to make sense of it. Okay, in other words, you've got this universe out there that you don't control and you can't simulate. You have to rely on reality. That's the natural thing.
You're saying Go is like extremely limited, restricted. It's a very few paths you can take.
It's a very simple universe.
Yeah, yeah,
okay, that you can simulate.
Yeah.
And because you can simulate it, then you can actually see the outcomes of everything.
So,
and go ahead.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, so in comparison to, like, when we hear about these, you know, the AlphaGo and the win of the AI over the human, etc., people are like, oh wow, we're getting close, right? We're there. It's going to be like in the movies now with this, you know, mother voice of this evil AI. It's going to take over.
Right.
No.
That's false.
Right.
Okay. You can get things happening that can be very impressive. I mean, for example, I believe that you actually in that that video about what's the name of that city?
Neom.
That the Saudis are
Neom. Yeah.
There was a video where Google had trained some simulations of robots how to walk, for example. Right.
That's right. Yeah.
And you can do that because you can simulate physics. You know, and because you can simulate physics, you can simulate robots that are operating in physics, and so you can have them running around falling down, and, you know, just like in Go, you can lose, right? So you have these little experiments that you can try and train these algorithms based on experiments or labeled data, if you will. And so you can get some things like that you can then translate into the real world that can make things that actually walk relatively well, because you've got, you know, you're operating with simple laws of physics, right?
Yeah.
So in that respect, you can get some pretty impressive results, and you will, and people will go, oh, wow, well, now we got, you know, these robots that can do all this stuff like a Terminator. And so it's mm-hmm. good. It's got all this intelligence. And, you know, there's a sense in which that the fear is rational in the following sense. The thing, you know, people keep on worrying about unfriendly artificial intelligence, and Elon Musk and all these other people, you know, it's like we're summoning the demon, right? The problem, though, is unfriendly natural intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Okay. And if you, you know, this whole thing about unfriendly artificial intelligence at this stage is a red herring blocking people in the concern, you know, basically blocking everybody from seeing to it that proper application of things like algorithmic probability are made and artificial general intelligence are made. Okay. And also diverting attention away from the real culprits that are taking advantage of huge data stores. Like, data is being gathered on all of us all the time, mm-hmm. which is really just a problem with privacy, right? I mean, what comes right down to it, you've got these guys that can observe all this data, and they have computer algorithms that are extracting patterns and stuff like that. But bottom line, the problem is the natural intelligence. Okay. And let me say one more level of abstraction beyond that, because it's important to understand. The global economy is in some ways a huge unfriendly intelligence that's trying to optimize for profit. And just like these mythic stories of a dangerous artificial intelligence that will be told to go make paperclips, will convert the entire solar system, including human beings, into paperclips.
Right. Yeah, the gray goo, you know, yeah.
Right. I mean, what's going on there is you've got this system that has a bad value function, which is, you know, some CEO of paperclip company said, make more paperclips cheaper, right?
Yeah.
And let it run, right? Well, that's what we've done with the global economy. Say, make profit and let it run. And it's running over the natural environment, and it's running over the people who are most closely wedded to the natural environment and their very nature, and that's us. Because Northern Europeans have only been civilized in the last 1,000 years. Okay, we lived in an environment that's much closer to nature, and that's why we fought civilization, because we saw the dangers of theocracy coming in and imposing upon us belief systems that were unnatural and making nonsense of very important things like words. Because mm-hmm. words, you know, if you mess with words, this is one of the reasons why, you know, I say it's an important thing to, if you look at the U.S. treaties with the Native Americans or the Amerindians, or the prior nations, maybe that's a good way to say it. When you make a treaty, you should hold it up. You should uphold it. And the reason you should uphold it is because going in and conquering with force, even with completely unbalanced power, is nothing compared in terms of immorality or whatever. Okay, is nothing compared to going in and committing fraud, as was done to us with the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. And the reason fraud is so much worse than force is because when you commit fraud, you make it so that you can't surrender. You can't have a treaty. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can't trust the word of somebody who has defrauded you and committed war of a fraudulent nature.
Right.
Because when they say, okay, it's treaty time, no. You have to kill them.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's very dangerous to be in a situation where you've gutted the human capacity for communication because civilization is this group selection phenomenon. It is warfare. And we have to recognize that we are at war and that there are those that we can have a truce with and there is those who we can't have a truce with. And trying to figure out who we can't have a truce with tells us who we have to just kill. We have to wipe out or somehow neutralize, you know, I don't know what we do with them, but we can't treat them as human because they have not, by committing fraud, you know, no, sorry. So anyway, that's one of the reasons why I'm trying to, sorry for veering off on that, but I want to try to make it very clear that, you know, this kind of fraudulent behavior, especially in the social sciences, has really created a situation where there are substantial portions of society and of civilization that, you know, there can be, we can't take prisoners.
Right, right. And let's take that concept and take that one step further and tie it into what they're trying to do, at least with artificial intelligence, that, you know, if that can be controlled, do you see that it can be used as a weapon as well? The advancement of what it will be able to process and understand and figure out, which we not have yet been able to, cannot that information and that knowledge be used against people, against different groups, et cetera, depending on who will end up controlling it? Because,
well, absolutely, you know, absolutely. I mean, and you know, the more information you have, the easier it is to figure out what's going to happen. I mean, you know, imagine, for example, you know, you're some kind of, you know, super intelligent thing that doesn't have any information, right? And it's trying to figure out, well, what do I do? Well, it doesn't really, you know much about its environment. And I mean, it doesn't know anything about its environment. But as soon as it gets its first bit in, it can start to, you know, according to algorithmic probability, start to adjust what it might do. The more information it gets, the better it can be at doing stuff. And that's true, you know, even if you got like Google or you or the NSA is gathering all the stuff, you know, it's like you can just go through and start doing what they call data mining and pulling out these gross patterns. It's sort of like what I did with those demographic variables. You know, I just pulled in some data and then, whoa, I got the stuff that, you know, really says something, right? And, you know, yeah, just getting the data and being able to do just normal statistics on it, you know, more data, you know, better statistics. You know, you don't even need artificial intelligence, just more data.
Right.
And those guys that have all that data have been like the credit card companies, the NSA, the now Google. You know, just it isn't so much that they've got advanced algorithms. All that helps. It's that they've got the data and we don't.
That's okay? True. Yeah.
And so we have to take whatever data is available to us and make the maximum intelligent use out of it. And that's why we can't ignore these principles that I've been talking about.
Interesting. Okay. So is there a way, if there's effectively, as if I'm understanding you correct, what you've talked about here with, you know, with compression and that there is a route we can go to maximize our ability to kind of reach not only artificial intelligence, but a way to process it. But if the elites and all those sort of that are investing and talking about artificial intelligence as using it at their disposal, if they veered off and taken a different turn, that's a plus in a way for us then.
Right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's my point. You know, that these guys are afraid of the truth because, you know, deep down, we see they really buy their own material to a large extent. And the way and they try to keep things in the sort of theological debate area because they know how to do that. And they don't know how to deal with actual truth. Okay. And so that's why they continually try to, you know, say things about like, oh, well, the data is biased and we can't, you know, and artificial intelligence, this and that. And they convince themselves of this stuff. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why they, you know, I'm fairly open about what's going on here. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that they should be paying me like $10,000 an hour for. I mean, more, right?
Right.
But it doesn't matter because they don't want the truth.
No, exactly. They don't care about reality. They don't care about
they want their dream world that they foist on the rest of us with government power.
Yeah.
And Hollywood, okay?
Yeah.
Because they're fundamentally a theocracy. They're a very intrusive theocracy. And they can't get away from that because it's who they are. Okay. But we're not that way. Okay. We have, you know, even though we have our limitations as human beings, especially given the fact that there was so much of our evolutionary history during the Pleistocene especially, that was individualistic in nature. You know, we just basically lived on our own with our you know, wives or our mates and our dogs and hunted. We had to deal with nature fairly directly, and that meant that a lot of the social evolution through which primates passed over prior millions of years wasn't as relevant for us. And that's one of the reasons that why we make really good natural scientists, okay? Because our individual, as an individual, we tend to relate more directly to nature. And that's one of the things that when we come into contact with other people, especially, you know, in a sparsely populated environment, if we can say things, it's really important to be truthful, to say things accurately. Otherwise, you know, you will end up basically fighting over some hunting territory and one of you is going to die. But being able to actually communicate means that you can actually increase the carrying capacity. Mm-hmm. But in environments where things are socially so, you have such high population densities, you know, that there's a food chain where some people are at the bottom of the food chain. And they've put us at the bottom of the food chain along with the rest of the environment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's true.
And in so doing, they've gutted science. And social science is a perfect example of that. Okay. So these people cannot pursue these things, and we have to.
Right, right. So what, I mean, it's a big step, of course, there, but give the viewers an idea of how, if people started putting time and resources into pursuing these things with the compression and all that, and actually, again, I don't know if even the term building artificial intelligence is the right term, et cetera. I don't even know how to define it, and I don't even know if we would put it in the realm of consciousness as we think of it, but what would be the benefits to us at this point in the struggles that we're facing have something like this at our disposal, James?
Yeah, for example, you know, we are in a war. It's undeclared, but there is a war going on. And in wartime, you need intelligence.
Yes.
If you don't know the structure of your adversary, then you don't know how to invest your resources. Okay. I mean, you know, for example, if we knew, I mean, you know, people have all these theories like, oh, the Rothschilds are like the behind everything, right? And what they're positing is a causal structure, okay, in society. And there are lots of things that we can do that don't necessarily involve violence, that may be low investment, that, you know, don't sacrifice lives or precious monetary resources that people just don't have because we've been bled dry by this theocracy. That if we had better knowledge of what the actual structure of the adversary was, then we could do things like, well, you know, let's like boycott this movie. And maybe that has big, you know, cascade effects.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Right?
So, prediction in a way, right? Of seeing the jigs are the puzzle in a way, and seeing what pieces, what node points in the war that we're in that are important, and what strategy to take at those points. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. What points have the highest leverage with the lowest cost?
Yeah.
You know, it's really, you know, what you're trying to, you know, figure out what the control system is and what's doing this stuff to us, right? What we're trying to do is we're trying to make it so that we can live our lives and, you know, so getting a measure of, you know, what it is that we see as, you know, symptoms of our demise and our destruction, and trying to figure out what's causing all that, what's really the causal structure of that, yeah, can tell us where to make our investments. You know, I saw this interview with these guys that are being dragged through the courts and all this money that's being wasted on these court cases. And then, you know, it really makes me sad to see this going on, you know, to see, because these poor, you know, some guys are getting thrown in jail, and we know that the legal system is set up to make it so that if you've got lots of money, then you can litigate your opposition into the ground.
Sure.
And yeah, if you, and it's just not not our strength. At least I don't think it's our strength to be fighting those kinds of battles. That's my opinion. Now, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but if we had better knowledge about the structure of the way these things are happening, then maybe we could make better judgments about how to deploy our resources. Mm-hmm. And so when people go out and they do demonstrations and are risking being put into the court system and the penal system, we know that we're making a good investment of that precious resource. Because these people who are going out there and putting themselves in line are very precious. Indeed. Like any soldier is very precious, and you don't want to waste your soldiers.
And it's also this issue, what I like to say is how do I put it? You're talking about studying the enemy, of effectively learning, like, what are they doing? I mean, they've certainly studied us. I mean, that's what they're doing. The elites have studied not only Western man, Europeans, white people, that they're studying everyone. They want to try to understand them, how to control them, how do we, you know, keep them in check, etc. And I think that they've singled out Caucasians, white people, Europeans, because, right, you know, they see that as a strategic threat to their advancement, basically. We're maybe creative enough, maybe out of left field, we can do weird things now and then that can actually upset, you know, their progression. But it, for the most part, James, I mean, we're still at a position where most people don't even know that it is a war. And the fight is to try to awaken our people to say, hey, listen, like, you are being targeted for who you are. It's a, you know, it's a discriminatory based on race that you are being singled out and seen as an enemy. And that is the bigger, like, the big problem now. We're not even at level one of this thing yet, which is difficult.
Right. You know? And maybe, you know, and people spend a lot of time arguing about things like, you know, the social science data, and like, well, here, look at these guys are ignoring this and that, the other thing, and you know the color of crime is something they came out with, and you've got the government responding by putting noise into the census data, but I think that if we can get to the point, well, let me paint a scenario for you. Okay, let's say that we are able to get something going where some data set, like the census data, has enough data in it so that it can uncover things like, well, the Jewish percent of whites actually predicts a lot, and there's actually, maybe there's a causal structure here, right? But do it with enough data, and, you know, at the county level as opposed to, say, the state data, the state level, that you get something that really can't be ignored by the academic press.
Right. That's an interesting point. I was just going to ask you about that. What if just we go ahead and build this thing and do it ourselves, right? And create a provable system that works and can show things in the real world, right? You can academically, right, scientifically prove them. And then into that equation, you can bring in things which is basically unpopular that they don't want to touch, right? It needs to, right, but what I'm saying is it would need to prove its worth first. Right, it would right, need to study other things, which the rest of the academic world would be like, "Wow, this is great! Look at this thing. These guys are, they've built a machine learning process, and it gives us all these correct answers about something." Right, this is a tactical thing.
Well, more to the point, if we can overcome this logjam that's been in place for 70 some years, going clear back to Harold Jeffries, okay, in terms of how we treat data, and say, "Look, you know, we have just cruised on by all the people who say, well, you can't use data because it's biased by white supremacists and blah, blah, blah. And maybe we didn't invent, you know, the next artificial general intelligence, but what we did was we produced this compressed representation of this broad data set, all these different measures and longitudinal data that's a smaller set of data. And we have this argument for why it should be paid attention to in terms of social science causality, right? And it predicts these things that are just a nightmare. And so you can't, it's like Trump's candidacy. You can't ignore it. You have to go after these people because they're white supremacists, right? But all you've done is the best you can do with data, okay? And you make them tell people why it is that it's invalid to use a broad range of social measures to control for things like biased sources, and you'll probably uncover some biased sources in doing this.
Sure, of course.
Whereas you'll say, oh, you know, this looks like it's kind of, you know, misbehaving, this data set's, you know, this measure looks like it's misbehaving. Oh, well, what do they say about it? Well, you know, it looks like that was biased by what? Well, so what you do is you put that, but you incorporate that bias into your algorithm that compresses that data, and you get a better compression.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you say, that's how you deal with bias, is you have broad cross checks so that you, when you have these outliers and you have theories about what the bias is, you just incorporate that and get better compression. Now, what's your argument against using this tool to compare social theories?
Mm-hmm. Because okay. That's another, sorry to interrupt there, but that's another interesting question that arises there, that if you would have machine learning that effectively would go out and let's say crawl the internet, right, to find all the data and information that it can about a certain things, if there just is enough information that is from the opposite side, if I can put it that way, potentially it would just pick up that as the truth, right? Well, this is verified. I mean, I don't know how this intelligence would operate, but I'm just saying this would be this would be a problem for anybody that want to learn the truth. There's just so much noise out there about, you know, this is not true, or this is true, or this is how things are, or this is how it functions, right? So again, how do you objectively come to that conclusion? How do you get a machine learning intelligence to come to the right conclusions, as opposed to just, well, this is the majority of the information that states this, so this must be the correct answer?
Yeah, this is a standard statistical procedure called cross-validation, okay? I mean, you have a broad range of measures from independent sources, and you get to the point where, well, you know, if you have enough different sources, it's going to be hard. It's like a liar can't keep their story straight, right?
Right.
And so, you know, in a court proceeding, you'll go after the inconsistencies of the liar's story. And yeah, there's a degree of consistency in the stuff, but you start getting to things like, for example, you know, genetic data and its relationship to social science data. And you're going between, like, you know, biology and, you know, these other broad measures. And it's really hard to get all that stuff to be, you know, consistent if you're a liar, right? I mean, you get all these cross checks that makes it so that you start to expose the bias in the data, because it has to, well, what Wilson called it, he wrote a book about it called consilience. You get a broad range of interdisciplinary data, and these guys, these theocrats, can't keep their story straight across all these different disciplines,
right?
And all these different measurements, and so you expose them. And that was, you know, what I was hoping. I mean, if the government had come in with, like, you know, $10 billion, what they should have for the Hutter Prize and the full corpus for Wikipedia, you know, you would have had potentially not just, you know, machines that could actually understand what people were saying, but would also expose the information sabotage and who was doing it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Fake news, all of that stuff that's going on right now, you know, that you would have algorithms and systems in place that would aid us in that process of basically, this is a lie.
Like, you know, this stuff, there's a whole broad range of guys that have the same story, and they're all inconsistent with, like, the rest of the measures of the universe.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Well, you know, they're theocrats who are trying to pull the wool over your eyes. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, trying to, like, do things like increase immigration for 50 years when 90% of the population opposed increasing immigration.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
It's warfare. Indeed. They don't want you to know that warfare is going on. And this, I think that what happens if you do this is if you just get this, like, you know, thing that they can't ignore. It's like, it says something about Jewish percent of whites, and it's like using this stuff, and it's like, now we have to, like, you know, do bad things. We have to pull it all, you know, we can't ignore this, right? We have to, like, call these guys all these names and bring in all of our sophistry. And the thing is that they're going to be going up against well understood mathematics, and they're going to be going up against Moore's law, and they're going to be going up against huge amounts of data that's been gathered. And the potential right now is to just wipe out the social pseudosciences with this weapon.
Yeah.
Okay. So you would just get one paper submitted like this. And what's going to happen is that there's going to be a lot of people. Well, first of all, if you simply set up the criteria in some kind of a contest, all these 4chan kids, it's going to be like, you know, this Russian kid. You know, they'll like, well, you know, I know how to do computers. I know math, and I'm a nerd, and it's like, and I understand that like these guys are full of shit about like social theory, and I can compress this stuff based upon looking all the measures and, you know, my understanding of what reality is and race realism, et cetera. And I can take into account the fact that there's biases and find the biases, and I can do a better job in the social sciences by a factor of 10.
Yeah. Yeah. We need all these autistic geniuses to join the fight here and not sit. Yeah. People shouldn't sit on their ass here and wait for, you know, artificial general intelligence to show up and showing us the road. We should have people working on it. What's your recommendation on this, James? If there's people out there that want to do that, where can they begin? Is there a project right now to initiate this? I mean, do you teach people on this or what?
Yeah, there is a project, and that was the Social Causality Prize 1.
Right. I mean,
this is actually the first in a series of prizes I'm calling the Occam's Guillotine. Because of the fact that, you know, this whole thing about the social scientists are really, you know, they're looking to have their heads lopped off. Okay, given what they've been doing to us in conjunction with the government. And if they want to save themselves, I suggest they get on the right side of that guillotine and start working on compression of the data and stop fighting it. Okay, I'm serious. They better do that. Okay.
Yep.
Now I want to say one more thing about the current status of artificial intelligence in regards to this. You know, Shane Lake, this guy I talked about, you know, went in, and even though he had compression, lossless compression as sort of like his PhD thesis as part of his measure, you know, they have not really, you know, you haven't really heard much about this particular aspect of artificial intelligence, all these people. And part of the reason for that, and there's a good reason for that, I mean, they should be talking about more than they are as in terms of a measure, but in terms of actually creating an artificial intelligence, there's a reason. The reason is that when you talk about any kind of compression, there's no such thing as a general compression algorithm that compresses anything. Okay, that's been proven, and it relates to the uncomputability of this Kolmogorov program. Okay, but what you can do is you can find tricks that nature has found in the form of human cognition that's permitted us to our limited capacity compress things and make sense of the world, even though we're throwing data away. And that's where things have been really focusing, is on modeling of the brain and primarily the neocortex. The human neocortex has really a very powerful general compression capability that isn't perfect, but it's really good. And it's not just the human, it's actually, this is a mammalian, and the humans are simply, we've got these, you know, smaller neurons, and we've got a lot more of them packed together to create much more sophisticated, more complex neocortexes. And really, the neocortex is like a whole bunch of parallel processors. And so they're all operating in parallel. And what people are wisely trying to do is figure out what the neocortex is doing, because if you can expand, I mean, we've got all this Moore's law that allows us to have lots of parallel processors, right? And if we can figure out how the neocortex does it, maybe we can translate that into all these parallel processors and have something that, even though it's not the artificial general intelligence that's a perfect scientist, it at least gets to the point that it has some of the same capabilities as humans with some of the same foibles, okay, because of the fact that it's going to be throwing data away. But it's the kind of thing where we can make some real progress in terms of getting something that sort of is an imperfect artificial general intelligence. And so that's what people have been working on, okay? There's stuff to be done there that is very important in terms of creating intelligences that could get us a long way toward this sort of ideal, especially in the social sciences, of taking broad data sets that, so you have something that looks sort of like a human brain, but it's very, very autistic. Okay. It's looking only at data sets and trying to get the smallest representation of it with human assistance, because humans have their ideas. They can draw on a much broader range of information than just the stored data sets. Okay, so they can start to provide suggestions about things that might be a good place to find some compression. Like, for example, we think we've got some bias in the data here that's biased in this particular way that would make it more commensurate with the rest of the data and thereby give you a smaller compression. So you have a human-machine relationship that takes place based upon this sort of naturalistic artificial intelligence, if you will, that can make some real progress. I don't know if you want to get into it now, but I did send you something about confabulation theory that has some spooky aspects to it that I'd like to talk about if you want to go there now.
Yeah, sure. We should do that. And would that be like one of the more important points, do you think, that we should squeeze in here towards Dan before we get too far ahead of ourselves?
Yeah, I think we can do that, and, yeah. And we can wrap up with this. Okay,
yeah.
Because
okay.
This is the kind of thing where there is something to be concerned about. Okay, in terms of artificial intelligence, not just the data acquisition. As I said, you can get something that has an operation like a neocortex that has limited access to information, but its access to information is broad in certain terms of data. It doesn't have the broad experience that human beings do, but it has broad access to data. And it can make fallible inferences based upon that the way the human neocortex does, okay, perhaps expanded to a large extent. Right now, we don't have, Moore's Law isn't at the stage where we can do something like the human neocortex. Human neocortex is still way beyond what we can do. But if we model the neocortex and limit it to data that we can gather, you can extract intelligence that can be very powerful, more powerful that can be extracted from normal data mining and big data operations that they're doing right now. Things like, deep learning or whatever, right? There was one of the founders of artificial neural networks back in the 80s, and applications thereof, I should say, is a guy named Robert Heck Nielsen. And he was at UCSD, and he was actually teaching there, and there was a course that was being taught on artificial neural networks that was from his students. I didn't take it from him directly, I don't think. I don't recall. But I know that one of my colleagues worked with him on applying the stuff to credit card fraud with his company, Heck Nielsen Computing. And the sophistication of that at the time wasn't very great. As time went on, got into the 2000s, he had enough experience under his belt about various models of cognition and learning and the brain that he came up with something he called confabulation theory. And I said earlier, there's a sense in which we live in a dream. Confabulation imputes missing data. In other words, there's stuff that we don't see, but we imagine is there for good reason. And this is produced under his theory by a process he calls confabulation. And the mathematics for it is very simple. And it can be parallelized. It's not, I've looked into this fairly deeply. And what he came out with at the time, he said, this is it, baby, this is it. And he developed this after his company, Heck Nielsen Computing, had been bought out by the largest credit rating agency, FICO. And FICO, of course, has huge data sets that does credit ratings. And it's also tightly connected to the intelligence agencies because of all the information that's available. And there's information sharing that goes on with these different agencies and companies. Something that happened, it was around 2006, and coincidentally about the same time that HoneyPrice came out, he did a presentation at Sandia Laboratories, and you might want to bring that up if you've got that handy. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. This presentation is no longer available on the web.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
In fact, it, it was taken off after I started talking about it. Actually, I think that there is an archive someplace, but I don't want to talk about the archive too much. Anyway,
and Sandia Labs, they do weaponry and stuff like that. Right? Sandia.
But anyway, Sandia, if you scroll down a bit, this is actually a presentation he made about an intelligence extraction system that was geared to, and this is like presented around 2006, it was projected in like 2015 to be, I think, $300 billion a year, just enormous. Jeez. And the people who were going to be working with the analysts would not know how it operated, but it was based upon confabulation theory, okay? The thing about this is that even though I've looked at this, I've actually implemented this algorithm and worked on compressing Wikipedia with it to some extent. My computer capacity that I've been working with is large enough to be able to do a good job, and so I can't make good judgments about it. But I think, looking at this very closely, I think that there are some modifications that could be made that are related to the current winning prize for the Hutter Prize for lossless compression, which was based on something called long short-term memory. It's a recurrent neural network system. This confabulation theory is not inherently recurrent. In other words, it doesn't inherently involve time and dynamics. I think that there's a modification to this could be done that may get to the point where you can actually start to get more of the capability of what humans do, but restricted to certain data sets. And I think that what he had in mind here was something that would be saleable to the government based upon requirements of the time to try to track down dangerous events that needed to basically sound alarms about, say, nuclear materials or whatnot. And, you know, shortly after this came out, you know, all of the talk about this theory went away. I mean, this guy is like, you know, a major league player in artificial neural systems. And all of, you know, all the guys, all of the students that had been involved in this stuff, he was trying to set up this new, you know, neuroscience stuff. It was kind of went incommunicado. Well, do you have the link to the Aurora massacre?
I don't think you sent it to me, though.
Oh, maybe I didn't. Well, that's a shame. I'll just talk about it.
Yeah, tell us what it was about.
The guy that did it is the son of one of Hec Nielsen's partners in Hec Nielsen Computing. And
I remember this now. This is interesting. Yeah, exactly. And they were the guy did some studies in, was it something to do with time, was it not?
He had gotten involved in an academic program to study various aspects of cognition, neurocognition.
Right. Yeah.
Primarily because of the fact that he was, you know, the son of one of the guys that was in the premier company that was doing all this really high power stuff. You know, and then he went and just, there's all kinds of theories out there about this guy, right? You know, mind control theories, what was up with this thing, you know, what was really behind, what was the purpose, you know, what was really going on.
Like a test, basically, like, could they get someone to do something like this? Is that what you're implying?
No, what I'm saying is it's a very strange, I'm just saying that I'll put it like this, okay? If I had the resources of the government and I was going to be doing an intelligence extraction system, I had to put money into confabulation theory and make some modifications to it related to recurrent neural nets, LST, long short-term memory, to try to, you know, get a unification between that kind of recurrent neural net and confabulation theory and see what it could, you know, see how close I could get to human level cognition and then supply it with this kind of data. Innocent, you know, I'm providing, you know, some humans that can provide it with some human guidance and, you know, like Mechanical Turk maybe, so that they don't even know what's going on. So it's entirely plausible to me that, you know, given the huge amount of data that's available and the sort of brain dead statistical world with respect to algorithmic probability, and the way the social sciences have just, you know, really, you know, done a scorched earth on treating data intelligently. You know, I suspect that where we've got the real advances are in places like marketing, you know, sales and marketing, you know, trying to figure out what's going on with you know, populations and making money for businesses, and in the intelligence agencies that may have some limited artificial intelligence capabilities that are well beyond what's available to the social sciences in terms of being able to do, you know, social causation networks and figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And this makes perfect sense, okay? If they're not doing it, well, they should, but if they're going to be on the opposite side of this war, I don't want them to. But right. Like I said, right. I think these people, you know, this is something that I think that if a contest like this were set up and it could get these young studs trying to prove their chops to each other, that they're better than the next guy, or some group that has like a little social theory, they want to say that, well, we've got a better unified social theory of the United States or whatever. You know, some of them may look at some of these techniques for trying to figure out how the neocortex works. And even though it's not a perfect algorithm for compression, which it can't be, okay, it may make some very serious advances and make it so that we can extract intelligence so that we understand the structure of our adversary better than the adversary understands themselves. Unless, like I said, you know, they've been wise enough internally to set up, you know, multi-billion-dollar prizes for their own internal intelligence. But like I said, I don't think that they're that. I think that these people that are like this, that are basically the, you know, the cultural Marxist version of the intelligence community that got founded under the OSS and the Frankfurt School.
Mm-hmm.
I think these guys, you know, they don't want the truth.
No, of course not. No,
they don't even want the truth for themselves.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I found that link, by the way. Well, one of the, there's a couple of sources out there when you search for the James Holmes and the Aurora shooting, and then Robert Heck Nielsen. They right. talk about his father, as you say, James Holmes' father, Dr. Robert Holmes. He received a PhD in statistics, 81 from the University of California, worked for San Diego-based HNC Software.
Right.
HNC known as Neural Network Company. And DARPA, beginning in 98, have worked on developing cortonic neural networks, which will allow machines to interpret oral and visual stimuli to think like humans, something you find in the, actually, and this is interesting, they tied together with the Batman movies because it was
apparently
something that happened in there in the movie, right? So the cortical
and you know, people are confabulating all kinds of theories, and that's sure. that's what our brains do, right?
Sure.
And we're trying to figure stuff out because we have very limited information.
Yeah.
And as this is one of the things I try to get across to people, you know, it's like, you know, there is no such thing as a secular government. Every government makes decisions just as do we all on limited information. And every decision you make with limited information embodies some aspect of faith.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're never going to be able to put yourself outside of that. It's like people who say they don't have, you know, they talk down to identitarians. Like, you're never going to be outside of having an identity. You're never going to be outside of being partial, you know, you're always going to be, you know, subjective according to your own worldview and what you think and whatnot. And that's why, again, that's why I think this issue with an artificial intelligence is so interesting. I don't know if it could achieve that place of objectivity, but hopefully it would. And hopefully the truth and reality is something which we could actually get an insight into with the aid of basically a machine-taught system that was right. kind of outside of the realm of having that level of you know, subjectivity that we have. And that would be interesting. And just to see what it would, how would it process reality? What kind of information would it give us back if we, like, tell us about this problem, why is this happening or something, right? And receive an answer back. Well, it's because X, Y, Z, you know?
Right. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, and we've talked about this before with the religion I've set up, and I've now gone public with it as the Fair Church. You know, the idea is that you can't get away from being a theocracy if you have a government, okay? All you can do is do as little to interfere with the individual agency of your fellow gods as you can in setting up whatever central government you do. And that minimum that then allows there to be these various congregations, or I call them ecclesias, okay, where you've got a local law that takes into account all of the details that people want to have govern the environment in which they're raising their children and in which they live their lives, so they can be human, because they don't have to be these machines that we're being asked to be so that we avoid prejudice and things of that nature. We can just go ahead and live our lives and enjoy them and pursue the direction of evolution that our chosen culture takes us. You know, that is really where we need to get to. And I think that one of the things that this can do is, in addition to providing more, because when we share information with each other about our different experiments that we're running with our loved lives that lived according to our faiths, our different faiths, when we share that information with each other, it's more than just like some kind of ecumenical thing. What's really going on is where we're respecting the godhood of each other and discovering the wonders of creation and how we can work with it to further creation. And so that's really, I think, the benefit of this, because beyond being able to just take a bunch of data and compress it with machines, we also have the opportunity for people to generate data with their own life experiences lived according to their strongly held beliefs. And that's really how we should honor the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation and escaping from the tyranny of the theocracies.
Interesting.
And getting on with generating clean data with good experimental controls, because we don't have things all confused and mixed up by, quote, diversity, unquote, which is really just novel heterogeneity and confusion. The devil is the author of confusion, and we've got a lot of devils operating on our society.
So, that is true. Now, that is true. Well, James, this has been a very advanced discussion, but I think the people that have made it this far, frankly, find it very interesting, because it's a very big picture kind of discussion that we've had, but it ties into something which is very, very specific when it comes to development, and we've talked about artificial intelligence. I guess the last thing I'd like to ask you about is, obviously people have, you know, they can go to your website, sortocracy.org. You have more information there about this, but are you in a position to have people reach out to you if they're interested in this, to learn more and how they can? I mean, I don't know if you're running this as a project or anything like that, but where if not, how would they begin if they're not running this as a project? How would they kick something like this off to get started on this?
Well, right now it's the Social Causality Prize won at the HeroX site. If people want to donate, you know, they can donate directly to that. I'm actually superseding sortocracy.org with fairchurch.org, and I'm going to be incorporating most of this kind of stuff into the Fair Church and the fair competition of ideas. However you do it, whether it's by lived experiments in your community, or by having fair contests between different theories that are compared by the degree to which they simplify the view of the world without oversimplifying the view of the world. Those are things that they can do. They can actually contribute. They can go and pledge money to the Social Causality Prize One. If there are guys who are really ambitious, they can go out and they can help gather more data at the county level, including things like religious affiliation, Jews, et cetera. The census did not include that in the data set that I downloaded. One of the problems with that, of course, is that if you try to publish based upon that, you've got people in the alt-right generate those data sets. They're going to say, well, you know, these guys generate this data specifically so they could come up with this result. So that's not what I want to do with the Social Causality Prize One. That I want to make something with that where there's a clean data set that was determined by the Census Bureau, so that it's difficult to get away with any arguments like that, even though I'm some kind of evil demon who comes to conclusions I'm not supposed to, right? I didn't invent this data. I didn't invent the theorems of artificial general intelligence. So it's going to be hard to argue with that. But if somebody wants to actually engage in the process of doing intelligence work for this war that we're in to discover the structure of the adversary, then helping to flesh out a broader range of data with more longitudinal data so that over time there's better information on the data, and working on things like just compressing it, using whatever ideas you have about how to compress it and make it compressed better, and compare that with other people to see if you can improve, beat each other and have a good fair competition between people who have their ideas about how the structure of our adversary is set up. That's good intelligence work for the war that we're in, and it makes it so that we can possibly make good investments and more and wiser investments. I'm not going to try to say this is something that should be done to the exclusion of the activism that people are doing. People have to make their judgments about that stuff.
Yeah.
But I am saying this is something that's neglected, and it needs to be pursued. And it doesn't. There's not that much money that has to go into it, especially if it can leverage this cascade effect that I got going, for example, with the Bowery Award for Amateur Rocketry that turned into the SpaceX and Bezos.
That's amazing. That's amazing that happened.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that could cascade, because it's the kind of thing that will just blow wide open.
Yeah.
The corruption of the social pseudosciences based upon their ignorance of, or their like studied ignorance of Occam's razor.
And it's an important area and an important field, because that's has been the crux of the situation, right? We've been convinced scientifically that these theories are false, and that our perspective of basically wanting to preserve the different ethnicities that we have on the planet, that somehow is scientifically wrong, or that we don't exist as a people, or that there is differences between people, right? So
arguments. As soon as these guys try to pretend that they're engaging in measurement, they're going to be walking into a blizzard of Occam's razors
or guillotines.
Okay. Well, yep. I'm giving them a way out.
Yep.
Okay. Their way out is to get with the program, because we're coming.
Yep. All right, James. Very interesting. Thank you for the discussion today. I really appreciate that. And as you said, I mean, fairchurch.org, then I guess that's where we can send people. And there's much more there for people to dig into. Nice animation there in the beginning of the page, by the way. I didn't realize you could grab the little ball there and stuff, That looks nice. I like that. All right. Well, thank you, James. I really appreciate it. Keep up the good work, let's do it again soon. Talk more soon.
It's been very valuable. Thank you very much.
Indeed. Bye-bye. Thank you. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Another show in the bag. Thank you for watching or for listening today. We really appreciate all of you guys out there tuning in and for all the support that you show for us. If you do like the show, there's a couple of different things you can do. One is to subscribe to our YouTube channel. And when you do, don't forget to check the little notification bell as well. You can follow us on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook, and I just want to mention as well, we have the members' website, and that's really the best way to support us. And as you might know, it's been down since the hack, since it was destroyed and disintegrated, nuked, gone, vanished, all that good stuff. Well, not good stuff, but it was destroyed. That's what I want to say. And we are almost there with it. We're very close. We ran into a couple of feature development snags, but those have been worked out, most of them. And we're very close. So I just want to say thank you to everyone who's waited, to everyone for showing patience and bearing with us during this time. It's been a process to bringing all of that back together again and making sure that we have a website that's, far exceeds the old one, so to speak. So that's what we've aimed for when it comes to the new site. So once that's up and running, and we're very close, as I said, definitely check out redicemembers.com. Go to the site. Sign up for a membership. That's really the best way to support us. Get access to exclusive content. The Weekend Warrior shows, all the shows that we've done in the past. We have exclusive videos, films, and inside episodes, and a bunch of different stuff. So, yeah, definitely, that's the best way to do it. We have also asked some of you to donate, and you can definitely do that if you want to help us out in that way. We appreciate all the help, and we accept all the help that we can get. If so, you can go to paypal.me/redice until the members website is up and running. That's really what we want to offer you guys. We want to give you something for helping us out. But I know that there's some of you that have asked how they can help out. So that's why we leave the donations link for people as well. So thank you so much to everyone who has donated and to everyone who's helped out for your generosity. Thank you again. All right, but we'll wrap up for now. So thank you so much again for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you are in the world, take good care and stay brave. We will see you next time. Have a good one.